Oh, thank you.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Leah M., recovered compulsive overeater from New Jersey, and your moderator for this morning. Today is Sunday, August 31st, 2025. The share ID numbers for Friday, August 29th, are the following. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 22,738. That's 22,738. And for the 10 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 22,739. That's 22,739. This morning, A Vision for You presents Abstinence from Anger. The Big Book teaches that to get over drinking, and for us, compulsive overeating, will require a transformation of thought and attitude. The 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to compulsively overeat and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. In other words, the 12 steps can keep us food sober and happy, bringing about a spiritual awakening, a change in the way we think, a change in the way we feel, and a change in the way we behave. Many of us assume that if we stopped compulsively overeating, practicing abstinence only, our problems would be solved. Unfortunately, this wasn't true. By stopping that behavior, we did solve some problems directly related to compulsively overeating. Perhaps we lost weight. Our physical health improved. Perhaps we were more alert. Maybe we moved better, slept better. Other problems persisted, however. Resentments, anger, outbursts, and rage continued to create problems for us and problems for those around us. Perhaps those problems stemmed from defects, and they did not go away just because we quit eating our binge foods. Abstinence is as we suffer from a spiritual malady. Liquor, says the Big Book, was but a symptom. So we had to get down to causes and conditions. Steps 4 and 10, the inventory steps, are the means by which we bring new vision and light upon the negative side of our natures. We examine our behavior and those character defects that cause us and others so much pain. Inventories and corrective action as needed keep our slate clean and our character defects in check so we can experience abstinence from anger. Joining us today to speak on this very topic is Sarah B., a recovered compulsive overeater from Michigan. Sarah is dedicated to our 12-step way of life, which includes carrying the message of recovery. It's with great appreciation that I welcome Sarah B. to the line this morning. Good morning, Sarah.
Thank you so much. This is Sarah B. in Michigan. And, well, that was a beautiful explanation. I feel so seen. Yes, abstinence from anger. This wasn't the topic that I expected to speak on when I first thought about this, but this has been the key to my true recovery, is becoming abstinent from anger. So I want to talk today, I'll qualify. I want to talk about my latest journey through the steps, particularly how it related to releasing the anger and having that lifted. I'll tell you about a few relationships that have transformed, and I will give you some ways that I've used the program to handle triggers. I remember my last outburst like I remember my last binge. So I've been abstinent from anger for about a year. I have been abstinent from, I've been abstinent from the food for about 17 months. I have about a year of being recovered. But I was in OA, in my 20s. I've been in an OA in and out my whole life. And I was working the steps in Vision and other places for, about 4 years. But it took me a while to get to this place of being recovered, and dealing with the anger through the steps has been the key to me truly being able to stay away from the food. So there's a huge, we're told on page 64 that the spiritual malady is overcome. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. And that has been true for me. So I came to OA because I was about 80 pounds overweight and sweets were ruling my life. They owned my mind, my time, and my body. They were my relief from stress of being the caregiver for my father. He had dementia and I was his live-in caregiver. At that point, the sweets were my entertainment, my comfort, my torture. I was often propelled against my will to drive for miles to get my fix and consume it in a parking lot, getting higher than anyone ever should, and driving home ashamed and sad. I mean, food had always been the unsolvable problem of my life. But this was towards the end of it, during the pandemic when I was caregiving, that it just turned, the volume got turned up so much. Much of my thinking was consumed with negotiating how to get it, how to stop myself from getting it, how to hide it. I was seeing a nutritionist. I had tried that and she was like, oh, you can have it in moderation, and I would try that, but it was total torture. I was like, try to cut. She was like, just cut a little bit, just have a little bit. It's like, okay. That was like impossible. That was an impossible experiment for me. I just never could do it. And I felt like something was so wrong with me that I could just never do that. And yet even professionals were telling me that I should be able to do it. I had a therapist actually who specialized in eating disorders who worked with me on my trauma and gave me materials on my emotional eating. And I mean, with her, I even had some success in terms of giving up sugar for periods of time, but it just couldn't last. I mean, I didn't know why it couldn't last. I just couldn't do it. And I was trying so hard, I was trying, I was getting experts involved. I was trying so hard. My first real white flag when it came to program was in the spring of 2021. When I had a similar 12-step food program and I asked her for help. I was like, okay, I'm ready for something. Something's got to give. Because I really was eating against my own will at this point. And she gave me a food plan. And with her help, I was able to have like my first miracle. And I followed a weighed and measured food plan and I released some weight, but I did nothing else. I did not work the steps. I did not seek a spiritual solution at that point. I just did the food plan. And I thought, This is what the issue was. No one taught me how to eat in the right amounts. I mean, I knew that I wasn't a person who knew what a portion size was. I had no radar for when I was hungry or when I was full. None of that, system in me worked. I mean, but here was this miraculous food plan that I could trust to do it all for me. I mean, it was brilliant. This was all I needed. That's what I thought. Then at 90 days, I picked up. And lo and behold, I could not get back on that food plan. No matter how much I tried, I could not get back on that food plan. And I was like, okay, well, I got to just get my resolve together. But then I thought, okay, but wait a minute. Isn't there something else here that I'm supposed to be doing? Like, isn't there something to do with like the steps or something? I mean, is that what's missing here? I mean, I didn't know what the steps really were. I just thought, well, I think I didn't do that part. So let me try something else. So I let that sponsor go. She had been a friend of mine. We're still friends. She was incredibly helpful to me, but I thought I needed to try out OA. So, I mean, I just barged desperately into this small local online meeting at the wrong time, disrespected the norms, and spoke out of turn. I knew nothing about it, but I was, you know, I was welcomed nonetheless. People were kind to me, even though I was kind of obnoxious. And there is a solution on page 25. It says, we were in a position where life was becoming impossible, and we had passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid. We had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could, and the other was to accept spiritual help. Well, see, I didn't know what it meant to accept spiritual help, but I knew that it had something to do with resentments. I mean, I knew that much. Many times I'd heard people like sort of bandy about the phrase, like, resentment is like taking poison and waiting for the other person to die. And of course, it made sense to me, and it would be like this, like, instant, like a quote that I'd be like, oh yeah, okay, wait, yeah, don't. Resentment is like, I'm trying to hurt the other person, but I'm the one feeling it. So I kind of knew that, but it wasn't like something that was like integrated into my life or that I, you know, really made use of. And listen, I knew I had a problem with anger, okay? I had a problem with anger that scared me. And I'm not going to say that I was a rager because I, you know, I worked in the mental health system. And even though I knew I had a temper and I had periodic outbursts, I knew about triggers. I knew how to leave the room if I was angry. I knew how to let my adrenaline burn off. You know, I had some sense of like how to manage anger in the way that I thought that I had a way to manage the food. But the truth was, I couldn't manage it. It would leak out. Sometimes periodically it would get ugly. And to be honest, probably a lot more ugly than I was willing to even admit at the time. And it had cost me relationships, these outbursts that would happen. So yeah, I lacked proportion in my thinking about anger. The outburst that really woke me up, I had an outburst in the fall of 2021 when I was starting to attend OA meetings. I didn't really have a sponsor yet. I was in and out of abstinence, but I had this partner that I wanted. I thought I was on this marriage path with, and I thought this was my happily ever after. This was like the relationship of my life, and I had a terrible, terrible outburst one day that scared the crap out of him, basically. It wasn't really at him, but it was near him. And it was the week that my father began his death spiral, and I was under tremendous stress. And so like, I felt justified, you know, I felt justified. Like, I'm going through this very hard time and you should understand that I'm kind of crazy right now. But nonetheless, like that, you know, that doesn't mean that there weren't consequences. And it scared my partner really badly, and it really slowed his role about the future trajectory of our relationship. And, you know, that was the wake-up call for me. It was the anger that was the wake-up call for me, actually, that I better take this recovery thing seriously. Because I had some sense that there might be a help in 12-step, that there might be help with anger in 12-step. So the thought of losing him was real enough that I was like, I better change and I better take this thing freaking seriously. So I'm going to skip. I'm not going to tell you the whole journey that happened there. I'm going to skip to April of 2024. So that outburst that woke me up was in 2021, fall of 2021. Spring of 2024, my father had died and my partner had left me. In no small part due to that outburst. Now, there were other outside circumstances having to do with his adult children that got in the way, but my emotional nature was a reason, a factor in that not working out. At this point in spring, or I'd been through the steps four times already, and I was abstinent-ish, people sometimes say. I was recovering, but not recently, which I just loved. I'd learned a lot by this point. So like I had 3 years in OA where I was like, I had had incredible sponsors and I had miracles with them, and I had made important amends. I was maintaining a 60-pound weight loss by this point. I was good at 10 steps. I was listening regularly to vision. I meditated half an hour a day. I mean, it was like half measures had availed me something. That's what it felt like. Like, okay, I'm doing okay here. I haven't quite got this, but, you know, my pattern was that I would get like 3 or 4 months of abstinence. I would get food neutral, and I would think, I got this. You know, I got this. I'm, you know, I don't need you guys. Like, I've got some weight loss here, and like, I'm not really like a compulsive eater. I just want to, you know, do my thing and leave. At this point, I'd had a sponsor who'd picked up, and so I wasn't really committing my food. I didn't have a sponsor. And I thought, once again, I could do it on my own. Well, the big book says on page 30 that many of us were unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove that we can drink or eat like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity and even death. How does this book know what I'm going to think before I even think it? How does it understand my behavior before I do? It's like, okay, right. So this is everybody. Here I am thinking I'm unique, like, oh, I got this. Like, this is the problem. This is the whole problem, is like that I'm going to keep on thinking that I'm a normal eater. And it's like, how many times do I have to prove like that I'm not? So, but I was kind of, like I said, I was kind of like thinking that maybe I was okay and I could handle it and I could control it. But then one day, you know, I'm thinking I got this. Meanwhile, the food is creeping back in. I'm experimenting with some sugar substitutes. And oh yeah, by the way, I'm driving around again from place to place. Like the car is driving itself, only I'm going looking for like sugar-free protein bars or something. I'm not even looking for the hard stuff, so it's okay. And then one day I drive by this sign, and the sign says, it's cookie day. And it was at the flooring store. Well, that was my, you know, whiskey in the milk moment, my unprotected brain. See, because my unprotected brain, meaning I had no spiritual protection. I thought, I got this. I'm handling it. I'm doing kind of okay with the food, but I had no spiritual protection. So I see the sign, and the car just turns right into the parking lot. And it's like I'm thinking, you know, just like Jim is thinking a shot of whiskey and milk isn't going to hurt him on a full stomach. I'm thinking, how can a cookie hurt me if it's from the flooring store and not the bakery? I mean, that's like my insane, out of proportion thinking. You know, I mean, like Jim, I vaguely sense this was none too smart. But I'm telling you, that time after having the sugar hit my system, sure, I got high from it for like 5 minutes, but it was like hell coursing through my body after that. I mean, just an inhuman craving. It was provoked, and it made me into a mindless monster immediately. And I saw it. I mean, I really saw it that time. I saw it like, whoa, this is scary and serious. This is no joke. This is like, I had a sponsee recently who put it in such a good way. I hope she doesn't mind I say this, but it's like, you know, I get activated by the food while others get satiated, you know, and I saw how it turned me into a monster. Like I had like, wow. A few weeks later, I left a memorial ceremony and my pockets were jammed with food. And I realized like, I'm just out of control. And I need to do this for real. And I called a fellow, I asked for help. There was somebody who had long-term recovery that I really wanted to at least work with, someone who had worked with her. And that person happened to be available. I was given her number and I called her, and she had space. And I just thought, oh my gosh, if I don't do this for real this time, I am never getting out of this. And one of the first things she asked me was, you know, to consider was, or she did it at a workshop that she invited me to. And I, you know, just took it to heart. Was, what is it that in all these attempts at recovery that I not been willing to turn over? like really turn over to a higher power? What is I hanging on to? And I knew immediately it was this relationship. That breakup happened a year before at this point, in the spring of 2024, and I was still pissed. I mean, I was so riddled with anger about the way the relationship ended. I was so wronged, so destroyed, so hurt. It was just completely unresolved for me. I'd tried to work through it before with the steps, and I hadn't, but I hadn't turned it over. And I was in so much like pain and anger. I just didn't, I was like 24/7. I didn't think I could actually be with it. You know, it seemed like it was like way too much for me. I made a decision to go forward with the steps for my fifth time. And I specifically looking this time for what I hadn't been willing to do before. I knew at this point that I would have to be rid of this anger. It would kill me, you know? You know, and I finally accepted, as it says on page 59, you know, half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. You know, I realized that all my half measures, well, they gave me something, but not really anything. And I thought I'd stood at the turning point many times. I thought I had. I really did. I thought I'd sought protection, his protection with care and abandon. But had I, you know, what had I not been willing to do? Why was I still so mad? Why couldn't I stop feeling so wronged? Why didn't I have protection from the food, like real protection? What did it mean to fully surrender to a higher power? I mean, I just knew that I needed to do it. Even if I didn't know what it meant, I had to surrender this anger to a higher power, or I was not going to be able, I was going to be subject to signs on the road controlling me. Like this substance was going to keep controlling me. And I didn't understand how the two were linked, but I knew that they were linked somehow. So my first day of abstinence, this abstinence, was April 8th, 2024. It was the day of the eclipse. No one was home. And I literally screamed all day till my voice was hoarse. I mean, I was so angry. And all this, I knew that, you know, in order to go through the steps, you know, there's that acronym people say, like fear, you know, face everything and recover, or F everything and run. And so I knew that I was going to have to face this, and it wasn't going to be easy. But, you know, I'd seen videos for a class of mine of people like, you know, withdrawing from opioids. And I just thought, geez, if people can do that, I can do this. And I just braced myself for a tough withdrawal. And it helps. It helps me to realize that it wasn't going to be easy. And in this step one, I let go of some foods that I've been hanging on to. Obviously, like, I couldn't do artificial sweeteners. You know, I also couldn't do caffeine, at least for a little while. That wasn't really addiction, but it was like, it was keeping me ruminating on the anger. Like, I couldn't release the anger without releasing that, at least for the time. I mean, full disclosure, I do caffeine now, but for that period of time, I couldn't do it at all because it just kept, I just had no shot of releasing the anger with it. So I went through this withdrawal, and a few weeks after I had gotten, you know, I was into my abstinence, I had another outburst. And this outburst really set me on the course of, like, taking this part of my character defects very seriously. I came back from a trip, and I had this roommate who was also a handyman who was, I came home and he had dug up my dad's hostas and replanted them to a different part of the yard without my permission. And I flew into a reaction. I flew into a rage. And this was to be my last outburst that I've had. But I flew into a rage. At this point, you know, I'd inherited my father's house. My father had died. It was a blessing and responsibility, but like the whole place was blowing up. I didn't have the money to really take care of it. This handyman was helping me. He was living there and making repairs. I mean, if I was a normal person, I'd probably just get a straight job and take care of the bills. But I was trying to be an artist, trying to be a writer, trying to do an unconventional life. But this moving of the hospice, for some reason, it was like reliving my father's death all over again. And this handyman, like I viewed him as also an unconventional person, kind of a wild card. He kind of pushed my buttons sometimes, even though I really needed him and we cared about each other. But he wasn't home that day, but my other roommate was, and I slammed doors. I wailed and cried because somehow, like I said, the hostas, it was like reliving my dad's death all over again. And I thought that this like disturbance that I had was just like me having a disturbance. Like I wasn't doing it at anyone, but like just like the one that scared off my partner. But I really learned this time, it really freaked out my other roommate. And she wasn't like, she didn't need that in her space. You know, she was deeply disturbed and she thought I was having it on her, even though I didn't think that. But that really was humbling for me. That was, here I was sober, food sober, really looking at it, really facing the anger. And I saw really clearly how I was impacting people around me. And I saw that even though I wasn't yelling at someone, that I was disturbing the peace. And I really had to sit with that in the steps, you know. And so I began, as I was going, this was early on in this particular step journey that I started this time in this abstinence. And I was like, I have to sit with this and stick my nose in this and stare at this and see how my outbursts have spoiled relationships. You know, I felt hopeless that I would ever be able to create any kind of meaningful life. I mean, I was drowning. I knew the steps were my only hope. But I will be teachable. So my step journey this time, in my own words, I really tried to put it in my own words. You know, I knew that I needed, because I'd been through the steps before, I needed to speak the steps in my own language to myself. I needed to find a way to speak it to myself that I could hear, because the disease talks to me in my own voice. It tells me I got this. It tells me all kinds of lies. I have a mental blank spot. I have something. I need a spiritual solution. So my step one, I realized I really do have a disease. It requires a spiritual solution. And I didn't know what that meant exactly. I mean, I knew my emotional nature was unmanageable, and that was part of it, right? I'm never going to be a normal eater. And I have a disease that requires a spiritual solution. And because of this outburst I had, I especially was catapulted into step two, realizing that I've got to have a meaningful connection with Source every day. Now, I was already meditating half an hour a day, but that wasn't enough. I needed to go deeper, especially with this shame around my behavior coming up. So I really started writing to God about this defect of my outbursts. I made my meditation chair my safe space. And I just wrote with just total abandon to God. I sat in that chair and I wrote to God. I let God write back. A fellow said to sit in that chair with my palms in the air and let the psychic surgery begin. Ask God to please rearrange me. That chair became my first safe place I'd ever had in my life to feel all my feelings. And I just let them move through me like a weather system. I mean, I think that rage or that outburst that would come out, it was kind of like a desperate thing. Like the emotion would build up and it had nowhere to go. I would just get like an impulse of discomfort. You know, we say restless, irritable, discontent. And I would just go right to the grocery store. You know, I would just go right to the food. I thought that I was in touch with my emotions because I had big emotions. But this wasn't true. I couldn't really be with them. And so in my step two already, even before step 11, I had to start having a meaningful connection. I had to start looking, seeking this higher power, this source energy. And I sought it through being in that meditation chair. When I hit step three this time, I realized that I would have to make a daily choice to pick love over being right, that my righteousness was fueling some of this rage. And I didn't want that. I was giving up love left and right to be right. I was, you know, this was winning out. This uncontrollable emotional nature was like killing possibility and love in my life. I was losing out on roommates. I was losing out on partnership, and that I needed to be humble. And I needed to figure out, I needed to learn to rely on God alone. I needed to learn to have this relationship and trust. If I let go of being right, that there would be love, that there would be something on the other side. In step four this time, you know, I really learned that if there is a disturbance, it is within me. If there is a disturbance, it is within me. And if I'm making someone else responsible for my upset, I am screwed. So if I'm disturbed, my first job is to quiet the disturbance. And that really, I mean, along with a lot of other things, that is the one thing that related to this particular issue that I really grabbed a hold of. You know, really was a way that I started to talk to myself about it, put it, you know, grabbing on the words that could make sense to me. Like, my job is to quiet the disturbance, not go after someone and tell them how they wronged me. I mean, I knew that, but I just couldn't control it all the time. Now here in step five, here's when I started to find out what I was really mad about. You know, sometimes it's said, like, not in the big book, but like another thing that people say is, you know, if it's hysterical, it's historical. So, you know, this time I mean, I'd done some pretty powerful fifth steps before, but this time, and each time I'd done it, I'd like uncovered another layer of, you know, something. This time we came to the sex inventory, and, you know, I felt like sort of confused about what to do. I did my hour meditation, and I realized that there was still something more in the sex inventory. And my, you know, was talking to me about it. You know, about something happened to you when you're young that wasn't your fault. That maybe fits into a resentment, not something you'd done. And I was thinking it was all me that had done things. But I had to go in for another, you know, another walk through after that hour of meditation that I did after the initial fifth step. And we had to do a couple of these. And I had to look at some early sexual memories, okay? Some things I'd never really inventoried before, because they weren't really currently like in my resentments as I saw them. But, you know, part of that was because I also had the I got this. I'm Gen X. I grew up tough. I grew up unsupervised. I grew up when stuff happened to me, and I was like, you know, I don't know. I just, look, I'm not going to go into it, but I've been assaulted several times, picked off the street by strangers, once at gunpoint, once when I was a child. And, you know, other things happened. My sponsor was kind of shocked, actually, at all the things that had happened, that I was kind of like being like, yeah, I got it. It's fine, you know? So this was really important to me, because what happened was, you know, we say, you know, we kind of clear up the wreckage of our past. I had made a lot of my amends by this point, but this was a different piece of it for me. I guess I really saw, we saw that this was a really important key to my freedom when it came to rage, because I came into my 20s smoldering with rage about things that had happened to me. And there was a lot of shame and a lingering belief that I was damaged, that I, and but I saw here, because of what had happened when I was young, that I sought sexual closeness. You know, I mean, of course it made sense that I sought validation in that. And really, that one of my defects is, I saw, was that I need special treatment. And I began to see that, you know, part of that was that I was covering up. I need you to treat me special so that I'm not damaged. You know, that belief that I was damaged was underneath it. So I needed that special treatment, you know, to prove that. So, like, it was like I held on to it, like I was entitled to it. I mean, it was, you know, so in step five, I began to feel less shame. I began to forgive myself. Like, okay, I see why I did that. You know, I believe that I was, a slut, or I believed that I was damaged. And so I sought closeness and validation in that way. And I don't know why. I really don't know why it got lifted. I don't know why years of therapy and writing didn't do it. But somehow this time, doing the inventory, doing the sex inventory, and really seeing all that in one place, I just got it. Like, my instincts were out of proportion. And it's okay. I forgive myself. I understand why I did that. And it really, I think it was like the root of a lot of my anger was living in that, you know, and it really released. And I, yeah. So, you know, then we came to the ideals, you know, and how it works, page 69, we ask God to mold our ideals and help us live up to them. You know, in the doctor's opinion, it states in nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than ourselves if they are to recreate their lives. So here, you know, I'm starting to enter into the psychic change. And, you know, a lot of the psychic change for me, I have to be a new, for me not to eat compulsively, I can't be the person that I was. I have to have a psychic change. And I have to have building new ideals is part of how I do that. So as I release some of this anger, I get to start to think about, like, who would God want me to be? I'd reinvented myself many times in my life, but never who I thought God would have me be. Not who I thought love would have me be. You know, who my creator would have me be. And that's what I would need to do. So in step 6 and 7, I, you know, started to look at my defects. And I thought, you know, I mean, the first step for me in having the anger removed, because obviously that was going to be the big defect, right? My outbursts, special treatment, and also self-pity. Those were the three main ones that I took a look at. But if I was going to be free of this anger, I had to become ready. And that meant also looking at where it had benefited me, right? So I knew that the positives to my anger was, you know, I was passionate. I always thought I was like wild-hearted, and that was a good thing. I was impulsive, adventurous, fiery. And I thought these were great qualities. But, you know, it turns out my impulsiveness is not always a great quality. And, like, my urgency, my wild-heartedness sometimes is like an urgency that doesn't really quite work. But also, like, it was my superpower, because, like, I work with folks with serious mental disturbances in Harlem in New York, in kind of a job training program for peer specialists. And look, I can be with anyone's anger. You know, people have outbursts, they come into my office, they sit with me, they have their anger, and I can be with it, you know. So I'm not somebody who was ever afraid of it. My dad had it, he taught it to me in a certain kind of way, but I could be with him and he could be with me, you know, and we could sort of let it drain off and be together. So it had a way, but, you know, and it also, you know, had these like ugly payoffs. Like it was a way of dominating. It was a way of ending a conversation. In a way, it's a certain kind of thrill, you know. The cost was, of course, that it cost me, you know, harmony and peace in my relationships. And it kept me uncomfortable, restless, irritable, discontent. It kept me in the food, you know. So I want to say that by this point, when I'm doing step 6 and I'm in the behavior plan, the food was actually fairly easy. You know, I'd had a lot of neutrality with food, and I was, you know, I was working the steps this time because I was looking for that spiritual solution, because I knew that I didn't have this. I needed to be humble. So I needed to cooperate with the removal of the food problem, right, by weighing and measuring, by turning my plan over to the sponsor every day, by having a food prep day every 4 or 5 days. That's an important part of my, like, you know, step 1 with food is, like, I got to prep it. I did these things when I was, you know, working with the food, and the food obsession was lifted. Like, so in other words, I have to cooperate with God or the higher power in order to have these things lifted. But now it was time to create a plan for my defects, my anger. So I could cooperate with the removal, because I knew, because I tried to manage this anger. I tried myself to handle triggers and all that, but it was still living in me. It wasn't pulled out by the root. You know, I needed this higher power idea to come along and lift this the way it had lifted the food. And that's when I realized what I had not seen before. The whole thing had been for this. abstinence from my defects had been the end game all along. And I couldn't see it as long as I was in the food, you know? I was blind to it when I was in the food, you know? And all of a sudden I understood what was meant by, okay, here, the big book, the important quote about anger for me in the big book, okay, I don't have the page, but you all have heard it, I'm sure, but this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found that it is fatal. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again. And with us, to drink or to eat is to die. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison. There it was. If I was to be free from the insanity of food, I would also have to be free from this anger. There was no other choice. You know, this was more than just emotional eating, you know, when I was upset. This was going to require a whole personality change. And so this behavior plan began to be the blueprint for that change. So I looked at my main character defects. I'm not going to go through everything on the behavior plan, but I do want to say the biggest one in my life at that time had to do with this handyman who was living with me, who was like, every time I would go away on a trip and come home, like something would happen in the house that would be like really triggering for me, like the fireplace left unattended or some heavy thing hung before it was gonna fall on someone's head, or something would be whatever, for whatever reason, a trigger for me. And so my main behavior plan at the time was just to expect this, not expect, I mean, as long as I'm choosing to have him around, not expect him to be other than he is. I would go into my own room, my own space, get quiet, have my feelings, quiet the disturbance, and then have a conversation with him. Because I had learned by this point that part of the things that I needed to make amends for in life was, you know, not having the hard conversations with people. And really, I realized, like, I've got no right to ever be angry with him if I haven't clearly stated my needs. You know, part of my behavior plan for dealing with anger is using my words, learning to say, I don't like this. You know, because my outburst is like this helpless, like, blah, childlike burst, you know. And part of recovery for me is learning to have the hard conversations and speak my, you know, my truth in a calm, clear way after having quieted the disturbance. There were other things, but I want to go ahead and read you the next. In step seven, I made my own personal step seven prayer. So I'm going to read that to you. I wrote, I had an assignment to write a step seven prayer. And this really helped me a lot, get humble and ask for these to be removed, because remember, I had tried to manage these on my own. And so I knew I needed God's help. I needed a help from a higher power to have this be removed. So my personal seven-step prayer. Dear God, I acknowledge that I have temper tantrums that have destroyed my relationships, that I have sought special treatment with an obsessiveness that has put me in harm's way and taken me out of myself as I sought my worth from outside sources. Obsession with food and with people has caused me to use food and people to fill a void that only you can fill. I've used my art to prove I'm somebody and to validate me. I've used that same sense of specialness or entitlement as an excuse to be lazy because I shouldn't have to because I'm special. I've wallowed in self-pity by isolating with food and wanting to hide out and avoid facing life. My temper and angry outbursts have made me lose long-term relationships in a single night, lose out on roommates and the finances and friendships they bring. It has made it so people don't feel safe around me, and so I don't trust myself. It's even scared away the one person I truly wanted to share my life with. My need for to be special has made me fall prey to manipulators and flatterers by placing myself worth in the hands of lovers, audience, students, and family members instead of from the eternal wellspring within. It has robbed me of the joy of writing. My self-pity has caused me to spend chunks of my life as the living dead, unable to feel joy, to interact with my fellow humans, or to be of use to anyone. It has made me feel sorry for myself and waste time on negative thinking and isolation rather than using the precious minutes I've been given on the planet to experience connection, curiosity, and creativity. I am now willing to give all of this up, to let it go. I know that I am powerless to do this on my own. I ask for your strength and mercy to lift these defects from my life, so that I may transmit love everywhere I go and to leverage my unique talents to be of maximum service to this world. I know that you can do what I cannot. I humbly ask you to grant me strength as I go out from here to practice kindness, tolerance, patience, and creative discipline purely as an opportunity to be closer to you. Thy will, not mine, be done. Amen. Oh, that prayer was powerful for me, and I worked with it as I worked through the steps. As I got to step 8 this time, you know, again, I was looking for what I hadn't been willing to do before, what I hadn't seen before in the steps, because half measures hadn't brought me all the way, you know. I was ready to go to any length. And I saw that in step 8, you know, there's this became willing to make amends to them all part. You know, it's not just made a list of persons we had harmed, which somehow that's all I saw, you know, but it's also became willing to make amends, which is forgiveness work. That is forgiveness. And even this far in, I still was in a lot of pain about this partner. I could not let go of what happened and the way that it happened. And I'm not going into the details of how it happened, but it happened abruptly, was not, in my mind, worthy of the relationship we had. And I was still just in a lot of pain around that. But there was one day on the Cornwall meeting when I felt my anger kind of break, you know. I'd been praying about it. I had some relief. But I was able in that one moment to have this perspective shift from bitterness at what I'd lost to gratefulness to what I'd had. You know, it happens in God's timing, right? And it was just a moment where I just felt this total gratefulness and I wasn't bitter. And the very next day, I ran into my partner in a place that we would never normally run into him. We were in like kind of a no contact situation, but there was a willingness to have tea. And I, you know, I don't know why these things, this is like, is it odd or is it God? I don't know. But we had tea, and instead of blasting him with how he'd wronged me, and I'd already made a few amends by this point to him in other times through the steps, but I, you know, this was stubborn, this one. But instead of blasting him for how he wronged me, I simply said, I'm sorry I didn't make it safe for you to stay close to me. And I felt God working through that. I felt that was true, that I realized in that moment that it was my job, however I may have been wronged in the past by anyone, it's my job to make people feel safe with me. That is my part. I can't afford to be angry, and I need, it is a long period of reconstruction ahead, and I need to be the one to make it safe. You know, obviously, step 10 comes along, and I need to continually look for my part. You know, I can't let these resentments collect. Step 11 has been a really important part in my relief from anger. You know, this chair that I have where I meditate has become my safe place, you know, where I write to God. And it, you know, I think of it as a journey from the cake to the chair. You know, in the food, I was irritable and I couldn't sit still and I couldn't concentrate and I couldn't be with my feelings. And I couldn't really be friends with the chair meaning the quiet, meaning sit quietly with myself and having my feelings, you know. But it took a long time, you know. I mean, I sometimes think of it as like a new friend. Like in the beginning of the friendship, you're like, God, do I even want to be friends with you? I don't know if I even like you, you know, this chair, this me, this higher power, this channel zone, this place where I feel things, where I sit quietly. It's like, what do I even do? You know, I mean, for a while, but it's like I've trained myself over time by continuing to return to the chair. I have learned to calm my nervous system. You know, for me, this is what the feeling of God is for me. It's a very, you know, in a technical term, it is a calm nervous system. I mean, it is a felt sense of safety that I get by sitting in that chair and breathing. And I sit in that chair and I have a journal open to a fresh page. And if I need to write a question to God, I do. And I let this inner wisdom, whatever it is, this source energy within me, write back and forth. And I, you know, I love this relationship. In the beginning, it was so painful. But by the time I'm in step 11 and I'm listening to the I'm reading the St. Francis prayer, I am beginning to feel my emotions, my intensity, the intensity of my emotions is beginning to drain. The chair is how I work to drain the intensity of my emotions on a daily basis. Now, I am a lot less intense than I used to be. Now, I'm pretty intense. I'm still intense. But I'm less intense than I used to be. And I am learning to calm that nervous system and that hot, triggered fight or flight, fight, whatever that was, that adrenaline, that, you know, hijack of the nervous system. You know, in step 11, I calm that. I am present with that. In step 12, you know, I mean, this time I find that I give freely, and I've learned the difference. You know, I made those three calls a day in the beginning, and now, you know, I'm there for other people. I sponsor. I'm in a community where I'm giving and I'm receiving. And when I give, I receive. It's different from like when I was caregiving, which was very draining. This kind of giving is very transformational. When I share my transformation, I get transformation back. And so it's a life spring for me, this kind of sharing of the program and sponsoring. And I would say, like, now I'm part of this community. I mean, my poor partner, you know, when I was in that partnership, I mean, there was so much pressure. All my emotional needs were like on him. You know, so much of my emotional needs now get taken care of by the program. You know, I used to be just so desperate and needy for people to take care of me. And now I have a lot to give. I'm like overflowing. And I have these friendships that, you know, give back to me. And it's just a beautiful thing. Step 12. So I want to say that, you know, so somehow here I am, I've worked through the steps. I don't even know how it happens. I don't know what happens, but the anger has been lifted in the way that the food was lifted. And it's a magical process. Just like I don't understand exactly how the cravings for the food were lifted. I'm maintaining an 80-pound weight loss. You know, that's just, I came in here for the food. That's all I cared about, right? I was just focused on the food, trying to manage the food. Well, now that's just not even, I have a weighed and measured food plan. My food is handled. I help others. I do these steps, and somehow I'm relieved of this obsession. I love my 11th step. I stick close to my higher power. And somehow that has worked with the anger, because I was trying to manage and control that, and it never worked, but somehow it's been lifted through the steps. And I don't really get it. But I do know that there is a long period of reconstruction ahead, and we must take the lead, as it says on page 83. And so we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. And so, you know, I've worked through these steps, but there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. My handyman, he moved out for a year. I got recovered. Then he moved back in. And I thought, oh my gosh, okay, well, now I have a chance to see what it's like as a recovered person being around him. And, he came back and triggered the heck out of me right away. He was, just it had it was a noise thing, and he's living on a floor with other roommates, and I was just I went through the roof with the trigger once again, but I kind of knew it was going to happen. But I thought, oh no, I made this terrible mistake by letting him back in the house. And but I thought, okay, you know what? I am recovered now, and I quiet the disturbance. I quiet the disturbance before anything. I hadn't had an outburst since the hostage. We actually joke about the hostage. We call it the hostage situation. When he moved the hostage, we're able to laugh about it now, thank God. But when he first moved back in, I got the disturbance, and I didn't talk to him about it for like a week or 10 days. I meditated. I was like, I've got to calm the disturbance. So I meditated, meditated, talked to God. Finally had a conversation with him. Well, we had to have numerous conversations. I had to have set numerous boundaries and have numerous clear conversations, about what was okay. And by the way, part of my managing my anger is knowing I run this house that I inherited from my father. I have roommates here. Important to me because I'm a landlord, and I need him to help me fix things. And the fact that he trades with me is a big deal. So the relationship is worth working on. But I, so I had to have numerous conversations with him. But lo and behold, I never had an outburst. I never had an outburst with him. And we have been able to come to an understanding. And I just think, like, I was ready to kick him out during that first disturbance, when he came back. But I'm so grateful now that, God has come into this higher power relationship, and now he is like, I don't know why. We worked it out. I didn't have an outburst. We worked it out through calm conversation, many conversations, but we worked it out. And he's here, he's living here, and he intends to live here long term. And that's a relationship that has transformed. Oh, I learned the difference between what I have to go to bat for in terms of setting boundaries and what I need to let go of in terms of micromanaging. That's what I was going to say. Like, I can't micromanage every little thing, but there's certain house rules that I did have to go to bat for and have the hard conversations about. But then everything else I have to let go. I can't micromanage how people load the dishwasher or even the thermostat or things being left around. Like, I can't make, that be my business. So that's one relationship that's transformed. I wanted to share two other relationships that's transformed after this. The other relationship is my brother, my older brother. He's 10 years older than me, and my relationship with him was always very constrained. I'm not, I mean, and I was sure that it was his fault. Like, he was difficult, right? I can't express myself around him. He's disapproving, cold, judgmental, But I learned through doing my inventories that I was, in fact, very self-seeking with him. I was needing his approval. I was looking for him to validate me. I was constantly bending my breath and hesitant. Through the process of making amends, because I had had outbursts and temper tantrums with him too, surprise, surprise, and I made, amends for being spoiled and tantrumy, and I, behave in a calm way with him around too, because in the beginning, I had to be like, oh my gosh, bless him, change me, bless him, change me, because I couldn't imagine I'd ever have a relationship with him. I just couldn't. I mean, but then there was that crack with realizing, okay, it's me, I'm self-seeking, I'm needing validation. He's not. Well, it's been a couple of years since my amends with him, and he came to visit me this summer. And lo and behold, turns out he's a great guy. He's a great guy. My nervous system here was in a calm nervous system. My nervous system was calm around him. And I'm happy to say, he's, people like him. He's smart. He's talented. He's generous. He's good to be around. When I have a calm, if I'm looking through the lens of myself, my defect of self-seeking, then he occurred as the problem. But when I stop making an idol out of him, gosh, I'm much more comfortable around him. And I think he's more comfortable around me because I'm not being a spoiled brat. So that's another relationship. I'm seeing him completely differently through this new lens. Like, he's a different person, but he hasn't changed. It's me. It's me who's changed. Somehow I've had this psychic change because I have to be this different person in order for me to stay out of the food. I have to be a different person. I can't be the spoiled brat. I can't be the temper tantrum girl. I cannot have outbursts with people and stay sober, stay food sober. So, but anyway, it's somehow it's happening, these miraculous things. Now, the hardest one was my partner, my ex. So again, with the long period of reconstruction, like this is someone, it wasn't a normal breakup. This is someone that I, both of us, even when we broke up, intended a lifelong friendship. He's family to me. He was a best friend to me. This is not a throwaway relationship. And this has been the hardest resentment to get over. You know, and I had to really look at where I, you know, the freedom in this program is, you know, I look at my part. I go to God and I make amends. And I do that over and over and over again. I have to continually look at my part. And I had to look at where, like, you know, before recovery, you know, I was like turning him into my make it better man, you know. Feed me, fill me, hold me, comfort me, give me special treatment so I know I'm not damaged. As long as you're treating me special, then I'm not damaged goods, you know, from, you know, what happened in my past. Like my brother, you know, I also made him my arbiter of self-worth, my value as a human being. I put him on a pedestal. I assigned him the role of filling the void, you know, and, you know, he was perfect. And, oh, by the way, he used to take me to eat all the time. He accepted and loved me when I was fat, you know. I felt like he was my healthy relationship, my prize for all the other bad ones. He was my happily ever after. You know, I never met anyone so calm and safe and so easy to be with. And actually, he's the one who taught me what it felt like to have a calm nervous system. And when he left, I was like, oh my gosh, I can't have this calm nervous system unless he's around. Well, I've learned to have it with meditation and my relationship with God. And that's where it belonged. It didn't. He taught it to me, but it didn't belong with him. You know, I can't go into all of it, but you know, I've had a lot of miracles with this partner. This summer we've had a number of resolution talks. Yesterday was the third one where he actually made amends to me yesterday. I had been making amends to him many times, and I, you know, my primary goal has been to show up as a safe person for him, you know, and I think he finally felt safe enough. Yesterday was the first day. I mean, it's just, maybe it's because I was going to talk today. I don't know. But, you know, I yesterday was the first day I couldn't feel an ounce of anger. I didn't feel an ounce of anger with him. And that maybe it's a coincidence. I don't know. But he felt safe enough and he made amends to me for his dishonesty. And the love was there, showed up. The old relationship showed up. I had felt very shut out by him. And that's part of why I was so angry. But the love showed up again, and, you know, I feel like I'm more able to hold on to the gratitude of what that relationship taught me. I've milked it for all the lessons, you know, because that's part of living a spiritual life for me, is like seeing for things for the lessons that they are instead of just the bitterness that I have. So that relationship has been transformed. It's been transformed. Doesn't mean we're together. Doesn't mean I have everything I want. But it's whole, you know, it's whole. I've taken my part. I've done, and I've made it safe enough for him to do as well. A few things I will say about managing anger, and then I'll wrap up. Because I figured, like, I thought, well, what's, you know, the thing that people might ask me would be like, how do you handle triggers? You know, so I'll just say a few things that I do, how I use the program to handle triggers. You know, I return to my meditation chair. Number one, take a time out. You know, that relationship with source within me, the infinite love, sitting in that meditation chair, letting the pain, the anger, the feelings just drain out, you know, of that chair. Even knowing that the chair is there helps me when I'm in a situation. I was in a situation, actually, I did feel kind of jammed up when my brother was there, and my sponsee texted me and she was like, okay, you know, you can return to your meditation chair. And it helped me pierce that self-seeking in that moment. And I was like, oh yeah, I can go back to the chair, bring that intensity down. You know, praying for the person is another way, you know, the freedom from bondage prayer, you know, praying for the other person's well-being. I did a lot of that. I'd say, like, also the reminding myself that I'm not entitled to anything. Again, a lot of times anger flares up for me, like, oh, well, I'm entitled to quiet. That person shouldn't be talking in the library or talking on the airplane without their headphones on or whatever, listening to things without their headphones on. And I just immediately feel entitled to, like, quiet and peace. And I'm not entitled to anything. I'm not entitled to perfect health. I'm not entitled to all these things. Another thing, so that really looking at entitlement, okay, that was behind a lot of my anger. Making amends immediately. I only had to call back one credit card person and chase them down, that I've been a jerk to, for me to not ever want to be a jerk to service workers again. Making amends is like a deterrent. Speaking in low tones, actually learning to modulate my tone. I had a tone that was angry that I thought was passionate and ardent, but that's not how other people experienced it. And I had to actually change my tone. Looking constantly for a perspective shift, through step 10, doing the step 10s regularly. Where are people not following my script? Where have I perhaps made up a story about what someone's doing? Where am I thinking only about my own wants and needs, not theirs? I really have to have that perspective shift. That really drains the anger. Sometimes I just have to burn it off by going walking. Don't believe what, I just have to burn off the adrenaline. Looking for the message or the lesson, anger may be a sign that I need to step away from something or adjust how I'm relating to someone, boundaries. Looking, am I making someone else responsible for my well-being? Am I making an idol out of them? My well-being is, dependent on my relationship with my higher power. I really think the big difference for me this time was catching it upstream in six and seven. Before I was trying to manage it. Once it came, I was managing in 10 steps. But I think really looking at it upstream in six and seven, like, okay, this is my entitlement, my need for special treatment, my demand, my hobbling demand that life go my way. These are behind my, my anger. All of that was an eye opener for me, so like I say, at the beginning, we're told that when we're told that the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. And I would say that that has been true for me. I'll just wrap up by saying that, I drive by that cookie day sign every Thursday and Saturday now. It's right there at the flooring store. They have this special day, but it's irrelevant. I just don't even see it. I just smile. It doesn't have any power over me anymore. I released 80 pounds. I've kept it off. But like the greatest problem I came to solve, the food problem, was not even the most interesting part of this whole journey. That, somehow miraculously through this process of the steps, the anger has been lifted, and that has been the final key to my whole life, to having my whole life work, my relationships, to be loving with everyone I come in contact with today, and to realize, like, I just can't afford it. The grouch and the brainstorm are not for me. I cannot afford them and expect to stay food sober. So I'm grateful to the process, to all of you for being with me through this process, so that we're in it together and I'm not alone. And with that, I pass.
Thank you so much, Sarah, for your inspiring and authentic presentation this morning. Beautiful. Thank you for sharing your compelling and remarkable transformation with all of us today. Sarah's contact information will be given at the conclusion of this recording. We will now transition. We have time for a few questions here. Of course, you'll receive her phone number for additional questions if you wish to do so. So we'll now transition to a question and answer segment. You can press star one to unmute. I can take a few names for a few questions this morning. I need
Pedro
your
B.
Pedro, go ahead.
Jason
Um.
And Jason. And let's take one more. Star one to unmute.
Aliyah A. Aliyah A.
Aaliyah A. Okay. Let's get started with Pedro B., please, with your question.
Thank you, Leah, and thank you, Sarah, so much. Well, it's really touching for me. My question is, you talked about quieting the disturbance. Is there any particular thing that you do in particular to quiet that disturbance when it shows up? And are you able to identify it? Because a lot of times I get into, you know, anger things, and I'm already, you know, screaming, yelling, and angry, and it's, oh, I'm disturbed, but it's, wait, do you see any signs, you know, to catch you with disturbance, and what is your practice to quiet that disturbance?
Thank you. So your question is, like, how do I see, what are the signs, you know, I mean, I think, I think, like, the program has taught me, like, I just can't, I mean, I've seen the consequences of it, so I know it's serious, and the program has taught me that I can't stay abstinent if I'm not free of this anger, so I take it very seriously, and if I'm even irritated, you know, if I'm even irritated, then that is important to detect, just like, you know, early signs of, like, oh, let me just put 6.2 ounces of fruit instead of 6.0. Like, that's an early sign that for me that the food disease is coming in. If I'm irritated, I know that I need to return to my chair. I just have lower tolerance for it, you know. I think that somehow, like, you know, it just doesn't come to yelling anymore. And I think because of the step work, you know, because of the seven-step prayer, because of looking at the behavior plan, you know. So I just try to catch it. I try to catch it in the irritation stage, and then I go to my meditation, and then I do a 10-step. And I look at, where am I being entitled? Where am I being entitled that things be my way? Where are things not following my script? Where do I think that life should be on my terms, you know? That really, it helps me to look at my part. It helps me to look at my entitlement and where I'm being righteous, you know, and to remind myself that I made a decision to not be righteous. I made a decision to not do that. And that I was going to let that go. And that's the way I'm going to live today. And so I'm happy to talk to you more about this offline, but it's, you know, it's a process. But, like, I couldn't manage it right at the anger point. Like, I have to catch it upstream, you know, and it's sort of like something I have to work on every day so that it doesn't show up. By the time I'm yelling, I mean, that's way too late for me. I have to be working on it. I have to keep my nervous system calm, make that a priority in my life, and then if I even get a little bit irritated, make an amend and do a 10th step. I hope that's helpful.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Pedro B. I will let everyone know at this time, share ID for Sarah's presentation, 22,740. That's 22740. Our next question comes from Jason KP.
Good morning. Thank you, Sarah. Really identified a lot. Really. A lot. Can you talk about this distinction between self-management and self-strategies and, you know, kind of working on yourself and working on the anger and an anger action plan versus, you know, God's grace and God doing things for you and where those things kind of align or intersect, or I don't know if you reflect on that, but I heard a little bit of both. I'm just, if let me know if that makes sense. If not, I'll try to clarify.
Yeah. Yeah, the difference between self-management and God's grace and where they intersect. I need to do my part. You know, I need to meet God halfway. I need to have a behavior plan, you know, and, you know, often it's about removing myself, going to my meditation chair, calling a fellow, going on a walk, you know, looking for a perspective change, looking for where I'm entitled. You know, I have those pieces that are my part, you know, to do, I have to do my plan. But then the really, you know, our higher power. So I want to share, I'll share a brief story. So like this practice and two-way prayer, because I do a lot to keep that channel open. You know, I was stranded recently in New York a couple times, like the airplane, what, you know, I missed, a flight was canceled and I couldn't get out a flight for a few days. And I was, I don't want to go into the whole story, but I was stranded twice in New York, literally stranded. And it was a situation where a lot of people were upset and having anger outbursts around me. And I just got very quiet because I'm used to getting quiet now in my meditation. And I just said, okay, well, what's the next right thing, God? You know? And I heard this little whisper, you know, try Philly. I was supposed to fly to New York. And okay, I ended up getting this flight to, I just ended up having this roundabout way of making a number of little decisions with God, like quieting my nervous system. So for me, God is not like this Santa Claus, give me everything I want, God. And it's not this muscle, force my way through life, God. It's a quiet my nervous system and listen to the still small voice within. And, you know, it's my job to quiet my system. It's my job to ask. And in that quiet, I get answers. I don't need to go explode. I can be kind to the service worker who is making the flights. I say, hey, you know, can we try this? Can we try that? And I find that there's this place between Santa Claus and pushing and forcing where I'm in partnership, where I'm like, my nervous system, I'm quiet, and I can hear like the next right thing. And that's where I feel like I meet God's grace, is when I do my part and God meets me halfway. And I don't understand how it works, but it's something like that. And I'm happy to talk more about it offline.
Thank you, Jason KP. And our final question for today comes from Aaliyah A.
This is Aaliyah A. Thank you so much. A lot of things resonated with me. My question is, you know, you said in your 20s and taking you back to that time, what were your needs from people around you back then? And now in retrospect, you know, looking back now that you are recovered, you know, I have challenges with a teenage daughter who seems to be angry a lot of the time. And I just want to be the mother, the best mother I can be. So just, yeah, if you have any experience, strength, and hope on that.
Wow. What were my needs in my 20s? You know, I mean, I don't know if I mean, to not be afraid of my anger, I guess that would be the thing. Like, I know that when I work with people, I'm not sure if I can answer it exactly, but I know that when I work with people who have a lot of anger, I just sit quietly and let them rage. I mean, not that they're at me, but sometimes people need to be explosive. And I just don't take it personally, and I see it as just needing to burn off, you know. And what I notice is that people, it's anger is like adrenaline. It's like cortisol. It's just like a chemical infusion. And, you know, I think, I guess I'm trying to think of someone who's been able to do that with me. Yeah. I mean, I just think that the worst thing is to be terrified by it. And, you know, if we can just, like, yeah, I can only answer it from, like, how I've seen it from the outside. I'm just not sure how to answer it from in my 20s. But when I'm with people, you know, at work where people are having anger outbursts, if I just let them burn it out and say, and I don't take it serious, I don't take what they're saying seriously. It's like, I view that as not, I don't view that as crazy. I view that as just like an adrenaline outburst, and I just let them have it. And generally, they usually calm down and are able to, like, kind of straighten up and fly right. So I just don't, I don't attach a story to it or a meaning to it. I just see it as adrenaline. And I think that if people are just heard and it not reacted to, that it it can often burn out. So I think listening, I mean, this is all just opinion. I mean, but I think listening, remaining calm, letting someone, not reacting to their reaction. Like as soon as we start reacting with and letting the fire go back and forth, it just, there's no productivity at all. But if one person can be accepting and calm, the anger will sometimes turn to tears and just melt. Like it's like a helpless rage a lot of times. So, I mean, maybe that's the question. Like, you know, what did you need? Like, what is it that you need? That might be a good question. You know, what do you need? Work with myself now. It's like, what do you need? What are your boundaries here? What is your unmet need? You know, what do you need to say that, you know, what do you need to assert in life that you're not asserting, you know? Like, I'm learning to use my words. So that might be something to do, is like, help her use her words. Like, what do you need? It's often a big feeling that is like unexpressed language. And if we can put it into a need or a boundary, some of that energy also drains away. That's just my experience.
Thank you, Anya, for your question. Perhaps we can squeeze in one additional question before we close. Anyone have something on their mind quickly?
Yes, this is Terry Bay.
Michelle M.
Okay, Carrie, go ahead. Please pose your question quickly. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. You might have answered it, Sarah, but like sometimes the historic, if somebody says something, trying to control me, I automatically find that sometimes I react and I don't have time to, you know, or I don't pause. I don't do it. So then I guess, I know I have to make amends. I didn't rage at this person, but I felt like she was trying to control me, and I talked back to her. And I, of course, don't know how she perceived it. But so sometimes there's not that, for me, there's not that pause. Or I just, you know, the trigger is, whoa. So,
yeah.
Go ahead, Sarah. Yep. Perhaps you could share some suggestions from your experience on that.
Well, it does happen to me sometimes. And I mean, I make amends as soon as I realize it. And amends is a big deterrent. You know, I make amends. I realize, too, it's like, maybe it, you know, no one, if someone else is responsible for my happiness or my rage, then I'm, you know, it's the disturbance is in me. So her trying to control me really is not the real thing. It's my thinking I'm being controlled. You know, other people just do what they do, and I need to toughen up a little bit and, you know, be kind and tolerant and realize I have choices in situations. So I try to do that. I try to make amends immediately if I can. I try to leave the situation. I try to breathe. I try to look at, well, oh, what? You're trying to tell myself. I mean, now I can shorthand and be like, oh, she's not following my script. You know, I pray for the person. Like I was in the dental chair the other day. This hygienist was like pissing me off because she was like just asking me all these personal questions in what felt like a public place. And I was like really irritated. And I just was like, God, please let me be kind to her. Please let me do things from her perspective. Please let me be gentle. Please don't let me lash out. Please let me be kind. And I realized, oh, she's at work. She's just trying to pass the time, you know? I sort of saw things from her perspective. And I don't know, just a lot of times my perspective when I'm angry is not the truth. I ask, please God, show me the truth. You know, I'm often reacting to a thought that I'm having, and I need to ask for that. I need to ask for grace. I need to ask in the moment. I need to pray in the moment for the person and for myself to be kind and tolerant. That's all I got on that.
Thank you, Carrie, for that question. Thanks, to everybody who posed questions this morning. And of course, thank you, Sarah, for spending time with us today. It was such a delight to have you on the line. So enriching. Thank you for your beautiful presentation. So inspiring. Today's share ID, 22,740. That's 22740 for Sarah's presentation. And we're going to close now from page 164. It's found in a chapter entitled, A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.